Welcome to the 12th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national dialogue on homelessness and poverty in America. The toll-free number anyone may call for this broadcast is 1-877-NOBODY-8. That's the word nobody followed by the number 8. If you're homeless, formerly homeless, or afraid you're about to be homeless, you may also call 1-866-LEFT-OUT. Coming up, a double testimony hour. We'll have the testimonies of many Gulf Coast Katrina survivors at one mic. And at a second mic, we'll also have three special testimonies from Riley Morris, an attorney with the Mississippi Center for Justice, who is taking on Mississippi Governor Halle Barbour, and Keith Burton, the editor of the online Gulf Coast News, which has become the Chronicle of Recovery, and Ohio Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur, who has a novel approach to keeping people in their homes, right after this.
I joined the Army to be 21 Bravo combat engineer, and after I went to basic training...
21-year-old Sean McKean joined the Army to get his GED and to pay for college.
So I just wanted to go to college, but my job in Iraq was to find bombs, the IEDs everybody else is trying to avoid, so I've been blown up a lot. I've been in close proximity to about 300 blasts.
McKean weathered the blasts inside an armored vehicle, holding his breath beneath a flak jacket and helmet. But the hundreds of bombs left him with a kind of emotional shrapnel, time to detonate when he was out of physical danger.
It all kind of blew up in my face. Just going home, I guess, blew up in my face. Really, I don't know if that's some kind of coincidence or what, but that's about how it happened. I guess after Iraq, I should have been used to it, but...
Less than a week after landing back in the U.S., McKean became homeless.
We got off the plane, turned in our weapons, and made our way back to the barracks we were staying in.
Did you think at that point I might be homeless within this year?
No, that thought never crossed my mind.
So how did it get to that point? What happened?
Well, I went back to my house, and I was only there a day or two, and it was just like fighting constantly. So I ended up staying at the homeless shelter.
McKean says he had no money in his bank account, no credit card, no education, and no civilian job experience when he returned from Iraq. He suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury, making it difficult for him to get along with friends and family, and almost impossible to get a job.
I have problems remembering things. I have headaches constantly now, like all the time, and sometimes those get really bad to...
He is part of a growing number of homeless War on Terror veterans.
We're seeing Iraq and Afghanistan veterans who are homeless.
Amy Fayerweather directs the Iraq Veterans Program at the San Francisco-based veterans organization Swords to Plowshares.
They're coming in very quickly. It's actually kind of disturbing because after Vietnam, it generally took about 5 to 10 years for people to end up on the streets. We're seeing people on the streets 3 months after they come home, 6 months after they come home.
The VA reports that over 2,000 War on Terror veterans have fallen homeless upon their return to the U.S. Fayerweather says there are three main reasons: lack of job skills, lack of affordable housing, but mostly post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD.
I think it was PTSD related. When I came back from Iraq, I didn't want to go anywhere. I didn't want to leave the house. So I was pretty much staying in the house, and the bills was compiling. So because of that fact, we ended up losing our home.
June Moss served 11 years in the military before she was diagnosed with PTSD and honorably discharged. Too frightened to leave her home and unable to get a job, she quickly lost everything. She and her two children became homeless within a year. Her kids thought the VA should have done more to help them.
Well, they always thought that you went over there and you did all that stuff, Mommy. The Army should have just helped us get a house.
Moss says it was her kids that kept her from succumbing to PTSD entirely. But most of the soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan are young, single men.
So we're on Haight and Clayton right now. There's a couple of good panhandling spots around. There's a place over here where I used to crash. You can sometimes crash in the park on Oak and Clayton, but not always. It's pretty high profile, pretty visible.
Ethan Kreutzer lived on the streets for nearly 4 years after returning from Afghanistan.
I didn't serve my full tour of duty because I had a mental breakdown overseas, and I was diagnosed by the military with PTSD. When I got back, I found myself homeless within probably a couple of weeks.
Kreutzer, McKean, and Moss all say that after spending time in a war zone, Reintegrating into civilian life was almost impossible.
Sometimes the whole world can seem against you because you're starting fresh when you leave the military. You have nothing that corresponds to civilian life, really. So when you go to apply for a job, you can't say, yeah, I was an infantryman for 10 years. That qualifies me to do what?
This is an issue that's going to get worse before it gets better. There's about 2 million individual members of the service or veterans who have been deployed to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. When and if these wars end, they're going to come home and they're going to separate from the military. Right now, we're trying to push back a wall in order to handle the folks that we have coming home now. When all of those people come home, it's going to be staggering. It's going to be a tsunami.
This report was produced in San Francisco by Anna Sussman.
Hi, everybody. I think I'm back on the air, and welcome back to the second hour of the Homelessness Marathon. This is going to be a double testimony hour because we're going to have testimony not just from people who have been affected by Katrina and people who have been homeless and so forth, but we're going to also have special testimonies from people at the microphone who are experts of one type or another. And there's the reason we're doing this is different from what we've done in the years past is because there is so much to be said down here. So much has happened to people. Even the quote-unquote experts have gone through the storm. So we have a lot of people we want to hear from. And at the microphone, we have Riley Morse, who is an attorney for the Mississippi Center for Justice. Riley, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Thanks very much.
Tell us, Riley, you're here, you're suing the state of Mississippi, as I understand it.
Actually, we're suing the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development over actions it took with respect to Mississippi's use of disaster recovery money.
All right, now this is an issue we stayed out of on the first issue, on the first hour, but this is really a disgraceful story. So let's hear the dish. What happened down here?
Well, Mississippi was awarded $5 billion in disaster recovery funds. Congress required Mississippi to spend at least 50% of that on persons of low and moderate income, which would include folks that are here at your event and other low and moderate income folks rendered homeless by the hurricane. Mississippi alone among the disaster impacted states sought to have that requirement waived, had refused to allow it to happen as to the full $5 billion, but then set about doing it piecemeal. And when it came to the second full anniversary, Mississippi diverted $600 million from remaining housing needs to fund a non-hurricane-related port expansion plan that it had developed prior to the storm. And this left no funds for some key categories, people like Dorothy McClendon, who's one of the plaintiffs in this case, who spoke in your previous hour, who's unable to put her house back together, renters who are folks, a lot of whom are in these trailers, who can't put their lives back together because affordable rental housing isn't available. And so we're trying to have HUD take a fresh look at that now that we have a new HUD secretary.
Now, this money that was diverted, was it because the port was completely destroyed and without this money there would have been no port?
Well, the port was heavily damaged. It may have been a total loss, but the port had $108 million in insurance, which is virtually the full amount of the value of the property. It was about $125 million. It also had FEMA money, and it also had other money available to it to put the port back together. It had some bonded revenues for capital improvements. But overlooking all of those resources, the state decided to take this one large chunk, the $600 million, from other equally pressing, maybe more pressing needs, and put it towards this port expansion.
But this was an expansion. This was just an expansion of business. This was money for the expansion of the businesses here.
Yes.
That was taken away from low-income housing.
That's yes, and not a modest expansion, a fourfold expansion, a fourfold increase in the footprint, and it's in an effort to try to surpass the Port of Los Angeles in containerized cargo. It is a feverish expansion proposal.
And it was done with the money for reestablishing housing for people.
That's what's been done. Now, our lawsuit's been filed, and those funds so far haven't been substantially spent, and we'll see how that lawsuit turns out.
But now, HUD, as I understand it, HUD said that it had no jurisdiction over this diversion, and that's why it was allowed to go through?
Yeah, HUD Secretary Jackson, what he said was that he had no discretion. He had no alternative but to approve it. And he even said that if he had had that discretion, he would have refused Mississippi permission to do this. We challenge Secretary Jackson's view that he had no discretion. We think he did have discretion under these laws, and he erroneously failed to exercise it.
What does the new HUD secretary say?
We don't know yet. He'll be coming to Mississippi and Louisiana toward the end of next week, and we look forward to in educating him on it in different ways.
Are you going to meet with him? Is he meeting with
him? I'm not scheduled to meet with him, and since I've sued his department, I probably won't be meeting with him face-to-face, but we've done everything we can to raise this issue with the transition team, and we believe it's on their radar.
Boy, you sue somebody, they just seem to not want to know you anymore, I guess.
You know, that's when you really ought to get to know somebody better, isn't it? Because that's obviously a place where communication's broken down, and we think this new HUD secretary, when he hears our story, is going to take a fresh look.
We have seen real change coming out of this administration in the last week or so, haven't we?
We have. We've seen some extensions of benefits for folks like the ones that are listening in here live at your program, and it's very meaningful to folks like this because they really are one week away from living in a bush. So if you don't have that extension out there, these folks are going to be living in the cold, alone, in fear.
And some of them still are. The people in the MEMA
cottages. Some of these folks here are
still under the gun. The yeah. FEMA people got an extension, but not the yeah. MEMA people, right?
Well, we're suing those folks as well. Business to try and push back the barriers to homelessness in every way that we can.
So you're really defending these people, and there isn't much defense for them here. Mississippi was not the most activist state in that way.
And Mississippi, like a lot of southern states, had a legacy of racism that sort of entrenched itself in the economics and in the land settlement processes.
Well, let me ask you, how much do you think is race? How much is class? I mean, Dorothy listed a lot of factors, so how much is what here?
If you look back generations, a lot of it is race. Mississippi coast area is settled along a racial axis that follows the railroad tracks. If you look north of the railroad tracks, all up and down this coast, you'll find the old African-American neighborhoods. And south of the tracks, where the view is unimpeded of the water, it's white. Now, there are also class issues that have to do with Mississippi being excessively pro-business and not sufficiently looking after worker rights and paying a living wage or a housing wage. It's a mixture at this point in 2009, but we have a long way to go before we can say here in Mississippi that we have put to rest the legacy of segregation.
Some of it, though, is, as Dorothy was saying, it's the accumulated pattern from before, where people were living, as you were just alluding to. It isn't necessarily all the active racism of today. Some of it is
That's
just
correct.
The result of the past racism that has never yet fully been overcome.
That's exactly right. But when you have that in place, and then you have economic disinvestment, economic lack of opportunity, and when $5 billion comes into a situation like that, and you haven't substantially improved those conditions, I'd suggest to you that our nation's failed a basic test of the times.
Okay, what last thing? We got to move on. So what are the prospects for your lawsuit?
Well, it's hard to predict any kind of litigation, but we do think that there is a strong likelihood that us asserting accountability issues in this case is going to increase the chances for fair treatment with stimulus funds in the future. We'll do our very best to make the most of this case, and we hope we'll be able to help people out.
Riley Morse, Mississippi Center for Justice, we thank you very much for sharing that with us.
Thank you for your program.
Thank you. Yeah. All right, let's take a couple of calls real quick before we have our next testimony here. Kenneth from Waveland, Mississippi. Kenneth, welcome to the program.
Yes, how you doing? My name is Kenneth, and I know Riley Morse very well, and
okay.
He's a very good man.
Okay.
He tried to attempt to help me and my wife after Hurricane Katrina,
mm-hmm.
due to the fact that two individuals at the Hancock County Zoning Department illegally evicted me off of my property after I tried to upgrade my mobile home to a newer one.
Yep.
And because my mobile home wasn't on my property, I had to store it at my business while I was fighting them legally. Katrina struck, destroyed the trailer by wind damage because it broke off some trees when a tornado went over my business. Destroyed the trailer. Because the trailer wasn't on my land where it rightfully should have been, which I found all the laws to prove this, which Riley Morse is well aware of. I didn't know you was going to have him on. And I've been denied all my federal assistance and everything because my trailer didn't sustain flood damage. Now, due to the fact of that, I was able to get the opportunity of a couple great individuals to help me out through the Salvation Army, a Miss Edie White and a Miss Carol. Helped us out through the Salvation Army and the American Red Cross to help me finish the house that I built, me and my wife ourselves, after destroying a home for somebody else and using the materials to start to build us a house.
You're doing it with found materials. In other words, again, people out there in America cannot grasp this. I have a hard time with it. It's like being on hold for some big corporation. Every time you want to get something done around here, there's another level of rules and bureaucracy, and everybody seems to be facing that.
Well, after I started building a house that was under a Hancock County permit, then they annexed me into the city of Waveland, and now my Hancock permit wasn't no good, so I had to go back through the bureaucracy of getting all the permits to Waveland, which I have to give them the credit that Waveland Building Department was very helpful at getting me all my permits and everything. And help me out on that. They was good about that. They didn't harass me or nothing on that. I was denied all my funds and all the assistance because my trailer wasn't on my property where it rightfully should have been when Katrina struck. I was denied all my federal assistance because my trailer suffered wind damage, not flood damage.
They just ain't passing help around here like candy is the bottom line.
They're not helping anybody. The only help that we've received here in Waveland, and I know as a firsthand witness, I lost my business after the storm, because after the storm, nobody had no money to come out. Me and my wife had a little bar and grill we ran for 10 years. Successful little business. We didn't make a killing, but we made an honest living. Mm-hmm. And it went under after the storm because there was no income. There was no money around here. And 3.5 years later, there's still no money here. There's still no work here.
All right. And I want to remind our listeners, you are speaking from Waveland. That is ground zero.
I am speaking from Waveland. Yes, sir.
That is the hardest hit community on the entire Gulf Coast in the worst disaster that ever hit this country. And
hey, God bless everybody that's come here to help us.
Right.
If it wasn't for the American people coming here and helping us.
Right on.
Oh my God, I don't know what we do. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much. On that note, I'm going to move on, but thank you for the call.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, we got a call also now from Guy in Fort Myers, Florida. Guy, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Well, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon, Guy.
Thank you very much. I heard you on the radio, and I called in that young lady to see into you.
Well, very good. What would you like to tell us? You're a homeless man?
I'm a homeless man almost 3 years. I was a victim of fraud. I lived in a mobile home park in North Fort Myers, and I was discriminated upon. I'm a New Yorker with a heavy northern accent, a little different than most down here in the South, and I was targeted. And there was a manager who was unlicensed who went to court on an eviction with a whole bunch of frivolous reasons. And she was able to obtain a writ through fraud against me, and the judge declared 6 weeks that I have to move out of the house and sell it within 6 weeks, and it was a very soft market. This is a house that I spent 2 years in building with my handicaps and disability. I brought it up to code, made a beautiful place out of it, and it's been a nightmare here in Florida for me. I came here 5 years ago. I came here for health reasons. I had disabilities, and I had to stop working up north. I was blind and walking around with a cane. So it's been quite a time for me. I was denied disability twice. I had an attorney. I was defrauded in court. But the good part about it is that the person that committed the fraud committed more frauds after mine than she was caught. But I don't have the money to proceed on finishing this case. It was a fraud against me and my family. Thank God I had some consultations from a lawyer who was a Bar Association president here who made all the calls. The attorney that represented me was disbarred. She's by the Supreme Court. She didn't do me much good. And it's just everything that could have went wrong did go wrong. I just couldn't believe that it happened.
Your story is a very common one. I mean, you know, just to be denied disability does not mean you're a faker. It's really more the norm, I think. I don't know what the percentages are, but a lot of people get denied before they eventually do get it, even if they deserve it.
Twice. With an attorney.
Right. And you still haven't got it, right?
No. As a matter of fact, I didn't even pursue that. I'd have to deal with this other crisis that I'm in with losing my home and two motorhomes, all the property in the home with my whole life savings.
All right. Well, listen, I wish I had more time, but I, my heart goes out to you, and I want to wish you all the best in your recovery, and I want to thank you very much for sharing your story with us.
Yeah, I stood up for what was right for not only myself, but other people around me, so they wouldn't be defrauded.
Well, good for you. Thank you, Guy. We got to move along, but thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. At the microphone, we have Keith Burton. Welcome, Keith.
I'm glad to be here. Keith, quite a surprise to see the turnout that you've got today.
Oh, all right. Well, we were a little surprised, too. I'm not sure. Never mind. Anyway,
well,
the thing is,
it's really very good for what we have and the circumstances that you're facing here. This is a very remote, in a sense, operation.
Right. We're in a location, which I should tell people about. Where we are, there used to be like 360 apartments that were all washed away.
Yes.
So it's we're right centered in where there was a great loss, but it's now a relief camp where there's this great outpouring of help as well. So it's kind of doubly symbolic. And, you know, we're out here under the stars, but it really shouldn't have been that way. There should have been houses here. Keith is the editor of the Gulf Coast News online. And if you want to know what's going on with the reconstruction effort down here, that's become an invaluable resource, Keith. And what I want to ask you about in the little bit of time we have, Keith, is, you know, we've talked before about the difference in the way recovery was handled in the 60s after Hurricane Camille and the way it was handled after Hurricane Katrina. Can you tell us something about that?
Well, I certainly can, and that's one of the real interesting things, and I've been watching that and making some comparisons myself over the many months since Hurricane Katrina. I was here in 1969 in August when Hurricane Camille came and slammed into the Gulf Coast, very much in the same area that Hurricane Katrina hit. And, of course, prior to Katrina, Camille was the standard bearer, if you would, of the type of disaster-type hurricanes that could hit anywhere in the U.S. It was the previous most powerful. It was also quite devastating to this area, laid waste to this very same location where we're at here in Pass Christiane and in Waveland, Bay St. Louis, Biloxi, in fact, all of the Mississippi Gulf Coast. The difference was, though, back then, was that we had so much more government involvement and military involvement in straightening up this area in the immediate days and months afterwards, which is different than how Katrina has been handled. For the most part, though the government has been highly involved in all the activities, it's entirely different. There has been more government working with private industry and corporations in doing the cleanup and doing the help and motivating individual organizations to get involved. Even so, we've had a tremendous outpouring of support nationwide from volunteer organizations, much more so than even during Camille back in 1969. But the big disappointment, and this is something that came up a while ago, I was in New York a few months in November after Katrina hit in August 29th in 2005, and I met up with the editor of Forbes magazine, and I was up there for the Online News Association. And he explained to me how he thought that the recovery efforts would be better served by corporate America than by the government in this effort because the disaster was so great. My view at that time and still today is that I didn't think the government had done a very good job up to that point, mm-hmm. a few months after Katrina. And my expectation was hopeful that corporate America would step up to the plate. They haven't done that so much. What I've been very disappointed in, and many, many other people as well, is that you talk about homelessness, you talk about lack of housing. It all boils down to jobs, more jobs, the type of work that people can afford to rent homes, the type of jobs that pay salaries where people can actually afford to live here and rebuild their lives. And that really hasn't happened. That's the part that's really disturbing about the Katrina recovery, is how corporate America really hasn't stepped up to the plate in moving jobs into this area, building factories or providing employment in areas that are not just casinos, which we have here on the Gulf Coast, and in military jobs or jobs offered by FEMA, for example.
Well, now, your critique of corporations, Keith, this comes because you're a lifelong member of the Communist Party?
Oh, absolutely not. I'm a conservative, as you know. And some people are saying, well, why are you saying this? Because really, frankly, I thought this effort by the nation, the Katrina recovery effort, would be one that would have greater focus, would be more broad and far-reaching as far as those would help this area. But I can tell you that if it wasn't for the volunteers, the church groups, the social clubs, the God knows just everybody that just came to help, this area would be far less further along. They're the ones that at the grassroots level really made the difference. But now to sustain this area, to move this area forward, to truly recover, we need the jobs, we need the employment, we need the type of industry that needs to be in this area. And one of the things that's been very disappointing, there has been corporate involvement in the Katrina disaster area in the form of GoZone money, special loans and tax incentives by the government to allow corporations to come into this area. But what hasn't happened? Well, let me tell you what happened. A lot of these jobs and a lot of these building projects have gone on in areas where the Katrina disaster zone was barely felt, the inland areas of the state. the inland areas of Louisiana and Alabama and Mississippi, far away from where the jobs are really needed to draw more people back into this area. What we're seeing right now is an outflux of people. The low to moderate income people that lived in this area are recognizing that they just can't make it here anymore. And in a sense, with the global economic disaster that's unfolding before us and the slow response the government has on that, as well as what we've seen in their response in Katrina, I'm very concerned that this economic impact is also significantly affecting this area as well. And we're beginning to see people move out.
Now, let's go back to this thing about the corporations, though, because this is a real question, and we've talked about it before. As a matter of fact, you're the one who told me that what happened down here is like a premonition of what could happen to the rest of the country if, God forbid, something happens elsewhere or when this economic tsunami rolls through. What exactly were the corporations tasked with in this recovery, and what was wrong with their performance?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that they listened to the wrong people, for one thing. The politicians in local and at the state level, and certainly at the federal level, are certainly trying to get these companies to come to this area. But the problem is that everybody's casting this thing as something that can be recovered quickly, and it is not, without a real strong focus on what the real needs are. One of the things that happens almost in every area is that the local politicians, the local people want to make people feel like the area remains economically viable, that it's going to be successful, that it's going to move forward. And in that sense, they give a somewhat rose-colored look at what's really going on, where the real data, the real on-the-street level, you see something entirely different. Like you have noted already in your broadcast, the broad areas of emptiness that remains here on the Gulf Coast. In the primary business core areas, say in Biloxi and Gulfport, which are bigger, the bigger cities here on the Gulf Coast, you see real recovery underway. But you don't have to go too far outside of town into the smaller communities, cities like this one in Pass Christian or in Bay St. Louis or Waveland or Pearlington or all the many other small towns that surround this area, to see that there's still a tremendous need and it's still a very big loss to the area. And frankly, that's the thing that I'm seeing. Homelessness is not just an issue that affects big cities or big communities. It affects smaller towns, and even more so, I think, in the near future with the coming economic problems that this country is facing.
Mm-hmm. I know that when we've talked before, you've talked about a lack of accountability and too little accountability and too much bureaucracy with the corporations.
There's no question about the level of unaccountability. You know, frankly, it starts off in local governments. They are doing the best they can. One of the most interesting things about the Katrina recovery is that you look at the scale of the disaster. These small towns don't really have a lot of money. They're really tapped out on a routine basis when things are right. And they didn't get any extra money to hire personnel to handle the tremendous amount of paperwork that they had to go through. Just to do one project of the scale that, say, a water and sewer project, those things really tax a small community, even a moderate-sized community on the type of disaster we have. But they had to use the same manpower that they had from the beginning, and so before the storm. And so it slows the process down. And that accountability right there, that issue right there is one that's important. Then you look at the corporations. Frankly, the local economies and the local governments are too busy to question what some big exec or big corporation is going to tell them they're going to do or not do. And the government has been virtually silent on this. You know, there hasn't been any real assessment, in my view, of what the corporate response to the Katrina disaster has been here on the Gulf Coast. Hmm. You know, you don't find any reports on that. Every month on Gulf Coast News, I get a report from FEMA over where they're at in the Katrina recovery and what they've done. To this date, I know of no such similar report dealing with corporate America's input into this area or into the Katrina disaster
zone. Nobody's watching. Let me just give out those numbers again. The numbers here to call in are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT, 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. Do we have anybody? I'm having trouble communicating with the booth, I'm sorry to say, so... Let me say that we could have a space for somebody at the microphone if we have one of the people here who wants to speak. We could have somebody there. Well, Keith, what else would you like to tell us about what should be going on with Hurricane Katrina?
Well, not so much.
What would you say should be the number one thing right now that should be changed if the Obama administration is listening, and let's hope they are.
I certainly hope they're listening. extra effort needs to be put on this issue dealing with insurance costs. That is the number one thing that is affecting our housing and business development here on along the Katrina disaster zone. It is ridiculous what people are paying. There seems to be no resolution on that so far in Congress. They keep backing away from it. That's something that should not be tolerated. A disaster can happen anywhere in this country, and we're seeing some of them occur. And if they face the same type of insurance dilemma that this area is currently facing, that has driven away a lot of people. It has forced a lot of people that could recover to turn away from this area. And as well as it stopped a lot of business development as well.
Well, you know, it just goes to show, folks, we don't discriminate against these flaming radicals on this show here.
No.
but I guess, you know, just to speak the truth around here sounds pretty radical. And you're a lifelong conservative, Keith. You want to give out the website for your Gulf Coast News?
Gulf Coast News? Sure, yeah. I'd be happy to. It's at www.gulfcoastnews.com.
And anybody wants to follow up on this discussion after we're off the air and learn what's going on, they can certainly go there.
I'd love to hear from them.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for sharing with us here on the broadcast. All right, at the microphone, we have another gentleman. Your name, sir?
Ray.
Ray. Ray, would you like to share your story with us?
Well, yes, I'm homeless.
Okay.
And rents are way too high in Gulfport. I live in Gulfport, and they tell me, I've heard that... these landlords aren't gouging. But, sir, I can't afford no $500 a month, okay?
Uh-huh, okay.
And, you know, and it's hard to find a job. I'm a licensed plumber out of Arkansas, and it's hard for me. I just got my ID back. I lost my wallet, and I just got it back thanks to Miss Chris Noss at Gulf Coast Community Center. She helped me get it, and... Man, thank God for her. She's an angel.
Where are you currently living? Where do you sleep at night?
I live in a mechanic's place. I live in a car that he has out there. It doesn't run. It doesn't do nothing. It just sits there in the yard, and I sleep in it.
Okay.
And virtually, I live there.
In your car. Know. And yet, why is there no work for you? I mean, I'm asking this because I think people just want to understand
because
this.
Because I've got no transportation.
So, in other words... It's not that you lack the willingness to work or the skills.
No, sir. I got a lawnmower that I go out and ask people if they want me to cut their grass. Well, I've got two businesses up on Pass Road that I cut their grass every 2 weeks. And I just finished Saturday with one of them. And they don't pay too bad of money now.
Okay, it's just not enough work for you. You're doing everything you can think of, though.
Yeah, I'm doing everything I think of.
And what would it take for you to get back into housing now?
A plumber's job.
But, you know, again, I'm asking you this, and I don't mean to be rude. I mean, we're just trying to understand.
Yeah, yeah.
People would think, okay, you're a plumber.
Yes,
you got the will to work, and
yes,
everybody's rebuilding. You'd think there's just a ton of work around here for you.
Well, I've went and applied, and like I say, I just got my ID. That was my big problem.
Okay, so they couldn't hire you because they didn't know.
Yeah.
For all they knew, you were an escaped convict from San Quentin or something, right?
No, I'm not a felon. I'm never a felon.
Okay, I know that, but I'm just saying that was what was the big stumbling block for you.
Yes, sir.
And
yes,
so now
sir.
You're hoping there's better times ahead now that you got your ID
now,
back.
I'm hoping.
Why didn't you have your ID?
I lost my wallet.
That's it?
Yeah. And my plumber's card from Arkansas was in my – it's the only thing I haven't got. Yeah.
So that's it. It just doesn't take much to destroy your life, really. You lose your wallet down here, and you're already doing poorly, and then, boom, you can't get work, you can't get nothing.
And I used to live beside the tracks in a tent, and the police come down there, and they run us all off.
When was this?
This is about a year ago, and they said it's illegal to be homeless in Gulfport.
Yeah, so you're saying the police have not been tolerant entirely. They're not saying, we understand everybody's got problems still after the storm.
Yeah, I realize what the police are doing, but, you know, they're trying to protect everybody. But I'm out of sight, out of mind, you know, and I've told them that, you know. I just don't understand everything they're saying. But, I'm not in public. I don't like staying out of the public, all right?
Mm-hmm.
But I just had to get up here very briefly and speak my word.
Well, I'm very grateful to you. And, of course, everybody listening, including me, is wishing you well on getting back on your feet. But it's very important for people to understand that that there's a lot of people out here who want to work or able to work, and it's just a struggle to survive down here still.
Yes, sir, it is.
Not easy down here after the storm.
No, sir. I got one boot here that's 6 months old, and it's ready to fall off my foot.
And why is that?
It's just rotted out.
Yeah. Because it rains a lot. There's mud around here, a lot of mud. Mississippi mud is quite famous.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much, and, of course, we want to wish you the very best.
Well, thank you for giving me this chance to speak.
Well, those numbers again are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. I see we have another gentleman at the mic. And, sir, what is your name?
Everybody call me Country.
Country. Okay, Country.
Everybody around knows me.
All right, Country. And what is your tale, Country?
Well, I'm homeless on the street.
Sir, can you step closer to the mic?
Yep.
Can't find work. There ain't no work around here.
Go ahead.
Police always bothering us. Everywhere we go, police is kicking us off, running us off. We ain't got nowhere to go. I think it's a very sorry job that the mayor's doing, that the sheriff department's doing.
Yeah, go ahead, Country. I'm sorry. I'm making signals here to the next person on the mic.
And if Obama don't step up to the plate, we voted all these people in, we'll vote them out.
And Country, what kind of work are you looking for?
I'm an iron worker and a roofer.
I see. And you're willing to work. Do you have transportation, Country?
No, sir. I walk or ride a bicycle to where I go.
Okay. And I'm
not ashamed to ride it to a job or ride it back home.
Very good. Well, we want to wish you the very best in getting out of your current circumstance and getting a good employment and getting back into your housing, Country. And we thank
all
you very much.
Homeless people around here.
Yeah.
I know most of them.
Yep.
They all willing to get up, go to work, but there ain't nothing here. And the police, they always want to bother us.
I see. Well, do you make a nuisance that they ought to bother you?
No, sir, I don't. I don't bother nobody.
Okay.
Everybody around tell you I don't bother nobody.
All right. Well, we want to thank you, Country, very much for sharing your story with us here on the Homelessness Marathon, and we want to wish you the very best. Thank you.
I think we ought to vote all of them out of the office.
Well, you know what they say, throw the bums out. But they got to show if they're bums or not first, I think, you know. All right, thank you, Country, very much. Next up at the mic, we have the Reverend Elijah Mitchell. Reverend Mitchell, do you want to tell us where you're from?
I am from the Gulfport area.
Okay, and what is your affiliation?
First, I'm a United Methodist pastor, Pastor H.A. Brown, United Methodist Church. I affiliate with quite a few organizations, such as the Coast Homeless Coalition, Interfaith Disaster Task Force, Coastal Family Health Center, and the list can go on and on.
Okay. And we asked you specifically to talk to us tonight about health care. What is the story if you're a poor person down here on the Gulf and you're sick, you need health care? How easy is it to get health care down here now, and has it gotten worse since Katrina?
Well, I can tell you about Coastal Family Health, since I work with them, is that we do offer health care for a person who do not have a reasonable means to support themselves. The health care is available. There's complement service, and we do everything we can to assist them.
Okay. But how does somebody get health care here? Do they have easy access to health care or not?
No, I'm in the community as a community coordinator to see that they can receive the health care that they need.
Well, are there fewer outlets for health care than there used to be around here now?
Yeah, I believe there are fewer outlets for health care.
Okay. Well, tell me some of the obstacles that people have. Are there any? Let's put it this way. There's lots of obstacles towards getting health care all around the country. As we know, people aren't insured. They have to wait in crowded emergency rooms. Are there any special obstacles that have come on down here since Hurricane Katrina?
One is transportation is a major issue for a person receiving health care. Secondly is finances, but Coastal Family Health do not turn anybody away because of lack of finances.
Okay.
Another one is communication. Person sometimes have difficulty communicating their needs, their health care needs.
Uh-huh.
All right. And I know that there is in Biloxi now, they opened a special free clinic and stuff like that. But were any of the hospitals down here affected, and were any of the existing clinics affected by Hurricane Katrina?
Yes, it was. Quite a few of the healthcare facilities was affected. The hospitals was affected also during the initial, right after the storm.
So are they fully rebuilt now, do you think? Is that one sector we can at least be glad to say has been more or less rebuilt at this point?
As far as my knowledge, the answer is yes.
So there is, but it's still a problem in terms of people don't have transportation, people are still scattered, they're harder to reach because they're not in their homes anymore. These are the kinds of problems you see?
Yes, and then it's a lack of trust. Some persons do not trust healthcare professionals because they've been turned down in so many different areas.
Huh. Okay. And did this get worse after the storm? I'm trying to get a feel for what happened with Katrina down here as far as this issue is concerned.
Yes. Some of it has gotten worse because we have a rotating persons that come into our community, and some are not familiar with the system or the personnel here. And trying to receive health care is a major problem for them.
I see. And are there any special problems? I mean, are you seeing people like who have been sleeping in, substandard housing, you know, where there's mold or something like that from the storm? I mean, are you seeing special health problems down here?
I do. From out the height, specifically from the FEMA trailers.
Oh, right. Of course. Yes. And what kinds of symptoms did you see down here from that?
I'm not familiar with all of them. Because I'm the one who make the initial contact, then I refer them to a health specialist or a provider.
But one of the things Elijah, Reverend Mitchell, I've been told is that, I love that name, Elijah, by the way. One of the things I've been told, Reverend Mitchell, is that that people knew about problems with this formaldehyde long before FEMA acknowledged it. Is that something that you have heard as well?
I have heard that also.
That people were complaining they couldn't breathe right in these trailers and
that
so forth.
That is correct.
And it took a long time before there was action there on that.
Yes.
Well, that's a shame. That's a shame. Is there anger about that down here, do you think?
Yes, there's a lot of anger, especially with persons I come in contact with who are having problems now from formaldehyde.
And are those permanent problems that they're having?
I cannot assess that since I'm not a...
You're not a doctor, but I mean, they didn't just go away the minute they left the trailers.
No, they did not go away.
Did not go away. And is this one of the factors that's making people skeptical of authority now?
Yes, it is.
Well, it's a shocking, terrible thing, of course, that people who were injured by the very things that were supposed to help them, you know, that's a terrible thing, and we really deeply regret it. Now, do you have a congregation down here?
Yes, my congregation is really in Wiggins. Mississippi.
Okay. And you know, now, I'd like your assessment about this, because what has happened, do you think, to the heart of the people down here? I mean, was there really a greater spirit of community after the storm, or was there more bitterness between people? How would you assess the change that way?
Immediately after the storm, there was a sense of community and unity.
Mm-hmm. And then what happened?
As things began to... And I can't say come back to normal, but things begin to, settle down. People start going in their different ways. And that spirit of unity and community seem to be dissipating now.
Well, I'm sorry to hear it. So it's not as strong as it was.
It's not as strong as it was after the storm.
Do you think it, though, has made a lasting change down here at all? I mean, is there going to be some residual effect left? I mean, did it break down, for instance, racial barriers for a while? Did it break down the barriers between neighbors for a while?
It broke down a lot of barriers. I saw a lot of barriers were broken.
Uh-huh.
But it could be, let me clarify that, things may have gone the other way because people getting back to doing what they normally do and trying to live and work and take care of things that maybe they're not able to get together. It's often they did when we didn't have any electricity or food was scarce and certainly water was scarce and needed ice.
Uh-huh. And you were here right here for the aftermath of the storm. Were you here in the storm?
I was in the storm.
And how long did it take before the aid actually arrived down here?
There were some first responders on the scene that I was able to see within 2 to 3 days afterwards. Where I was living, I couldn't get out for 2 days myself. I was blocked in.
Okay. So it wasn't immediate, but it was, okay, 2 days, 3 days. It wasn't as bad as in the Superdome in New Orleans, though.
No.
Not as bad. But how long do you think it was before enough help arrived, at least everybody could eat?
I would say within, and I'm estimating now, within probably 60 to 90 days.
Right. So that took a while before everybody even had basic supplies, basic services and everything, just
yes.
For that. All right. Well, Reverend Mitchell, I want to thank you very much for sharing with us here on the Homelessness Marathon and for filling in this piece about it. And, of course, we wish you and your congregation and everyone here the very best as this process continues.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Okay. All right, those numbers again to call in here again on the Homelessness Marathon are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. And I'm told that we have Guy, who is formerly homeless on the phone, a vet from Minnesota. Guy, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi, Guy. Thank you for your patience. Well, would you like to tell us your story, Guy?
Well, I'll tell you parts of it. I was homeless for 3 years, and it's been over a decade now since I got out of that. It kind of, I think... The big thing that nobody notices around working on homelessness is the president Bush created the Interagency Task Force on Homelessness in the year 2002. And since that point in time, we've dumped tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars into ending homelessness. And you look at a state or a national level, and one thing you notice is that there's more homeless now than ever. And what I've tried to focus on recently, and I've done a lot of national and local.
Oh, we've lost Guy. Well, maybe somebody in the booth could get Guy back, or we could get, or Guy will call back. I don't know what happened. That's a call we've lost, so something is not right there with the phones, and I hope somebody will correct it. Maybe we have somebody else who'd like to speak at the mic right now, because we don't have any, we've lost our phones. So we can maybe see if we can get somebody at the mic. Is there somebody who would like to speak at the mic there right now? Well, I guess... Okay, well, while we're waiting to have things restored, I'll just give you some of my impressions here. And I can tell you that when I first came down here, I was really struck by it. How much, you know, one of the things that when I came down here, I was very struck by the fact that I was having many conversations with people where I was saying, you know, I never knew any of this. And then people were telling me, yeah, that's right. You never knew. And that's one of the striking things about this, which is that this is one of the most covered news stories of the last 100 years. And we don't really know anything about what happened to the poor people down here. That should tell us something about the situation in this country as far as coverage of poor people's issues is concerned. Now, oh, we've got Guy back on. Those numbers again to call in are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. Guy, are you back on the phone?
Yeah, sorry. I don't know what happened there.
Well, neither do I. I think we've had a little trouble.
Anyway, what I've started focusing on was that, you know, why is there this colossal disconnect between the national homeless organizations, you know, National Alliance to End Homelessness, National Coalition for the Homeless, National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty? Why aren't these guys dealing with things like the fact that 1 in 32 Americans, according to Bureau of Justice Statistics, about, what, a month ago they released a study, it said 1 in 32 American adults is in prison, in jail, on probation or parole. And when you get out, and like the gentleman Country said before, it's pretty hard to be on the street in a major urban area and not have the police mess with you. Well, you get a record for that. And you're already in a bad situation. The situation's exacerbated by the fact that now you have, you know, numerous arrests due to the fact that basically we're existing in public space with no other alternative. And none of the major organizations focus on that. You know, we have 1.8 million Americans have now deployed to Afghanistan or Iraq. They're coming back. People read the headlines. Large numbers of them are having problems with PTSD, traumatic brain injury. The RAND Corporation last year said that 300,000 veterans of the current conflicts have PTSD, 320,000 have a traumatic brain injury, and there's overlap between those two sets. That's fully almost a third of the people that have deployed. And yet, when you look at the advocacy agendas of these big homeless organizations, there's nothing addressing any of that stuff in there. And you start wondering, why is that? You know, and as I've gotten to work with these groups, you know, I think that in the 1970s, for example, or 80s, very often people advocating for ex-offender rights were people who were ex-offenders.
people that were working on homelessness were homeless people or had been formerly homeless. You don't see that anymore. Now the route to social justice advocacy is through a master's degree in public policy at a major university. The problem with that is they missed the boat.
Well, you know, let's not go too far with this, but you're right.
Yeah.
There are many different kinds of organizations, and some are more, shall we say, accommodationist, and some are more fighting organizations. I want to tell you before I let you go, Guy. Thankfully, the phones are back on, so we're actually able to take calls again. And those numbers are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866 left out. But I want to tell you, I asked people. You know, you talked about the Interagency Council on Homelessness, which is headed by Phil Mangano, and I talked to Keith Burton, who was on. He's the editor of the Gulf Coast News.
I've met Phil before.
And I've talked to David Barria, who is a state senator. I've talked to an aide to Gene Taylor, who is a congressman down here. I've talked to a bunch of people, Kathleen Johnson, who runs Hancock County, Katrina Relief, the hardest hit county, and all of them put together. You know what they had to say about Phil Mangano down here? They all said, who is he? He has never even made an appearance. The guy who is...
Ostensibly, he made his reputation working with homelessness, working in Boston with homeless veterans. And I know a lot of people out there, and they'd never heard of him either.
Well, that's the point.
But he's no longer... The thing is at some point, you know, if you go on the National Alliance on Homelessness, and sure, there's a lot of organizations out there, but that is the umbrella organization for most of the major national organizations. You go on there, and one of the things that I note is the inaccessibility of the staff on that, for that organization.
I got to move along, Guy. We're running out of time, but I want to thank you. And I want to say about the National Alliance to End Homelessness that they're one step away from being devil worshippers, as far as I'm concerned. That's a very bad group, and anybody listening to that, I could go on. But pay no attention to the NAEH. They are not a good group. They are not the friends of homeless people. I can guarantee you that. We have Paul from Bodfish, California, on the line. Paul, are you there?
Yeah, I am. How are you?
Well, I'm just fine, Paul. Thank you for joining us here on the Homelessness Marathon. What's on your mind tonight?
Well, I wanted to thank you for your show, and I've listened for several years now, and I think you're right on the ball, and it really makes me think good of people that you're right there in the middle of it every year.
Something I'd like to point out is
I'm a small businessman, and I'm 1 month away from being homeless. I have to give my landlord my 30 days notice this next month because business is so slow.
What's your business?
I design tools for bicycles.
Oh, okay. My son is an ace bicycle mechanic.
Well, tell him about my website. It's morningstartools.com.
Okay, morningstartools.com. Well, folks, we don't really do promos for business on this show, but you've heard it here. So if you're looking for bicycle tools. You're here to say, really, Paul, though, that it doesn't take much of a downturn to make people homeless if their income was marginal to begin with.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And I'd like to point out that this current economic tsunami that we're seeing is not an accident. It's designed. The Eastern Bloc of Europe is having the same problem. Russia went through it years ago. And it's big banks in Europe that really are throwing their weight.
Well, you know, when I started this broadcast 12 years ago, one of the things I used to say is when the canary dies in the coal mine, it's not a veterinary problem. And that was something that was said, you know, every homeless advocate said, it's not just about homeless people. It's about an economy that's gone wrong, and it's going to go wrong for everybody sooner or later if it's spitting people out onto the streets. So I'm here to say that if people had listened to the homeless advocates instead of the bankers, we'd be in a lot better shape.
You're absolutely correct. And if you don't mind my pointing out that the people who are running our country, or I should say ruining our country economically, really are not Americans. They're working for European old money, and they see us as just another colony.
Well, you know, that's an opinion some people have. I'm not going to get into that. What I'm going to get into is that we need more help for the poor people here.
Yeah.
And I want to thank you very much, Paul, for your call.
Thank you very much for your show and
good luck
for
to
taking
you.
My call.
Good luck to you. I hope you don't become homeless. Thank you, Paul. At the microphone, we have, what is your name, sir? What is it? I'm sorry, I can't hear. Your name, sir, is?
My name is Ken Harris.
Ken, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon. Ken, would you like to share your story with our listeners? You're from here. Where are you from?
Actually, I'm from New Orleans. I've been here for 10 years, and I live not far from here. I live a couple of blocks from here.
And you were here when Katrina hit?
Yes, I was.
And what happened to you during the storm?
Well, my family, they all live in New Orleans, and I was supposed to leave out with them. But I had a friend that lived in DeLille, Miss DeLille, not far from here. And we went out there, and unfortunately, things was a whole lot worse than what we thought it was. So I went through the brunt of it. It was terrible.
And you are homeless. Were you homeless before the storm?
No, I wasn't.
Where were you living?
I lived right here in town.
And you had like an apartment or something?
I had a home.
You had a home? Did you own your home?
Yeah, I owned my home.
And now you're homeless?
Not home. Well, you can say that. I have a cottage on my land right now. I'm working on.
You got a MEMA cottage and you're trying to rebuild.
Yes.
And what are you facing now? Are you somebody we should think has got it made now?
Oh, no, by no means.
And why not?
Well, things are pretty tough. I was a police officer in New Orleans, and unfortunately, I got shot and it retired me. But when I moved out here, things just became a little bit more hard on me. At the time, I lost my insurance. My insurance lapsed on me about 2 months. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to catch up, and within 2 months, Katrina hit and lost everything.
So you mean your insurance had just lapsed before Katrina?
Yes, sir.
A lot of people had problems with insurance that wouldn't pay, of course.
Exactly.
But you just were in the bad luck. You were out of insurance just when it hit.
Exactly.
And what's happening in terms of being able to rebuild now for you? You have no money to rebuild. Is that the problem?
Well, we have some, but we just in a process. Things are taking a little longer than we thought it would. But you know we're
but the point is that you're in the situation that a lot of people are in, which is that you had enough money to live before the storm if you didn't have to rebuild a whole house.
Oh, right? Yes, sir.
So in other words, it's that the storm created a hurdle that you didn't have before the storm.
Without a doubt, yeah.
And would you say you're the only person in that situation?
Oh, no, by no means.
That it's just all over.
It's all over the place. Yeah.
Right. And it's just that storm took away people's homes, took away their housing.
I can remember when I was a kid, my grandmother's been here about 60 years, and we can remember this place looked like a postcard. And when you come out here now and you look at it, it's unbelievable. Things you see it. It'll never catch up in my lifetime. I mean, not like I can remember.
So this whole idea that people have, well, it's 3.5 years, must be okay now. What would you say to that?
By no stretch of the means, the street that I live on, we had trees that came from one side of the street and met, you know, and met over where it looked like you're looking through a tunnel. Mm-hmm. And I mean, in my lifetime, we never see no beauty like that anymore. I mean, it's gonna take. They say that they talk about the 100-year storms. I'm talking about 100 years probably. Look, that's the way it looked like, you know, before we could recover like that.
And you're here now, you know, we don't discriminate, and neither did Katrina.
Exactly.
I mean, we take anybody at the microphone, and we'll talk to you. And if you had been an illegal immigrant, we would hear your story. But in fact, you were a policeman. You're a patriotic American. You were not somebody here who was against this country. You didn't come in illegally. I'm not saying everybody who came in illegally is against this country, but I mean, you're somebody who did everything kind of the right way. You got a job. You worked for the city. You did all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And there's still not enough help for you here.
No, it's not.
And what would you say about the role of the relief groups here, the voluntary groups? How much of a difference have they made as far as you can see?
The voluntary groups. I was lucky enough to be with a family that knew some people that knew the Murphys. They own the oil company, mm-hmm. and I was in a position where volunteers came in real fast. We worked. I mean, we really worked for about 14 days straight. We had trucks come in, and we had to dispense stuff. We had to pass things out to people. But I was just fortunate enough to be in the right place where.
So you did get help from the volunteers.
I did get help from them.
We're almost out of time. Let me say to the callers waiting online, we're going to have an open mic hour when we come back. So we're going to have more time to take calls and talk to people, and we're going to take your calls and things then. But for now, you got a last word or something that you'd like to say so our listeners will understand the kind of situation that you're facing.
Well, we're gonna face this. It's gonna be a while before we fully recover. Let's just hang in there together, and hopefully we can work this thing out with God's help. We'll be okay.
Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing your story here on the Homelessness Marathon, and of course, we all want to wish you Godspeed and good luck with your. With your rebuilding effort. And we're going to come back in just a few minutes. We're going to have an open mic hour, 877-NOBODY-8, 866-LEFT-OUT.
You are listening to the Homelessness Marathon, produced in conjunction with Community Radio WQRZ of Waveland, Mississippi. The opinions expressed in this broadcast are not necessarily those of the producing or participating organizations or of the originating and affiliated radio stations. To order CDs of this broadcast or to contact the Homelessness Marathon, go to homelessnessmarathon.org.